give an example of a judgmental statement. Then we can analyze it.
Okay. Being half German, I grew up in Germany also.
Okay, don't give me background. Just ask a question, darling.
There are people that might...
Max, don't worry about other people. You've been such a kind... You're a very good example of really kind heart. I can hear it. I can even hear the way you talk. You have a lovely heart. You're very kind. Even though you're gently moving into this brutal question, you're trying to take care of everybody, and it's not your job. So, Max, just be sincere and say, what the hell you mean? Which statement is judgmental, you think, coming from the Buddha's teachings? Forget what other people think. We're discussing what you think.
Okay, echo of past actions.
Huh?
Echo of past actions.
Echo what?
Like, if someone's done something wrong in a past life.
Yes.
In turn, they are now, they can find themselves confronted with a situation that...
We will experience the fruit of it.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Good, so where's the problem?
Well, I mean... I find that's very tit for tat, you know. It's very
Max, tight. Max, I hear you, baby, and you say you're a Buddhist. You've got to listen more clearly to the Buddhist teachings. I have been stressing so strongly. You're not hearing, and this is why, in your mind, like all of us, we hear it like that, darling. There is no judger in Buddhism. There is no creator. There is no punisher. There is no rewarder. If your doctor says to you, if you smoke cigarettes, you will get cancer, do you say that's judgmental, Max, or not? Give me a simple answer. Thank you. But it's going to be pretty shocking, the results, if you smoke, isn't it? But why, when you hear that if you kill, you will get killed in the future, be born as an animal, why do you hear that as judgmental? It's Buddha in exactly the same way as a wise doctor telling you from his direct experience that he has seen that that is what happens. It's a natural law that he has found from his own experience, and he is merely presenting it. So that means, this is why I'm pointing out it is so hard for us to hear this, but analyze it carefully and you will see it is not judgmental. He is telling us his experience. He might be right and he might be wrong, Max, and guess whose job it is to find out? Yours. And if he's wrong, you say, thanks, Buddha, I enjoyed your company, I'm leaving. And if he's right, then you start practicing. It's up to you, precious. How about that as an answer? Good, but it takes time to hear it, because you must have heard me say 100 times in the room since just yesterday, there is no judger, there is no rewarder, there is no punisher, because there's no creator. It's got nothing to do with deserve or not deserve or punishment, but that's how we hear this, Max. That's our view now, because you, like us, have got ego grasping, which is the root delusion. That means we have created the view of judgment and punishment and reward. We have created that philosophy, Max, and that is deep in our bones, and Buddha is arguing with that philosophy. So it takes time to hear it. Are we communicating, precious? And it's got nothing to do with the middle way, baby. Say something. You're allowed to.
Will you get into the middle?
I certainly will. Because we can't do this job here of transforming problems unless we understand emptiness. We'll go nuts if we can't. So stick with it. All right? You okay? You're being a good boy and just saying yes, or you're understanding me?
No.
You're a very kind person. Even can tell by the way you talk, you've got kindness in your heart. And you want to make everyone happy, which is good.
I grew up with the Dharma. You know, that's, I was born in a Dharma center, and I grew up with Geshe Rukhten and also Geshe Rukhten.
Well, you haven't heard the teachings well enough, Max. You should have with Geshe Rukhten. Okay. Just keep listening, Max. Keep being ruthless. Keep being ruthless with your intelligence to cut through and get to the logic of all this. Okay? Worried about other people. So sweet. Some people might get... I believe you, darling, but you guys paid to come here. I didn't force you. You know, you can walk it out any time. I don't mean it in a mean way. I don't mean it like that. I mean, if a person comes to me who is a victim, who's in a crummy relationship with Ron, I wouldn't talk this way, Max. I would never talk this way. I have prisoners. They're not interested in Buddhism. Their heart is broken because they've been wrongly accused. I will love them and praise them. I will never talk about karma to a person like that. This is if you've got to hear it. This is if you want to say, and you said you're a Buddhist, so you want to hear this, baby. I would not say this to some people, because you've got to know where a person's at before you say something. So I'm assuming, because you guys have bought your ticket to come here, that you're ready for it. Maybe somebody should have warned you. That's what somebody said, because I'm a bit intense. They said maybe we should warn people that you're intense, Rabina. That's your problem. Are we communicating, Max? Good. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I mean, Max, you jumped the cut. Yes. Go, baby. The which? Oh, good, okay.
When I was very young, I had an operation, a surgical operation on my appendix.
Mi hanno addormentato.
And then I was sleeping.
In anesthetic, under the anesthetic. Yeah, yeah.
Poco dopo, mi sono svegliata. Ero nel buio, quindi non sentivo assolutamente il corpo, ma la mente era sveglia, per cui il primo pensiero che ho avuto è come faccio a dire ai medici che si stanno preparando a tagliarmi che mi sono svegliata.
When did you wake up? On the operating table? Oh, I understand. On the operating table.
Yes.
While they were operating. Okay, good. I understand. I understand. I hear you exactly. Yes, I understand you, darling. So what's the question?
La domanda è, la mente quindi può essere attiva anche se il cervello è spento, perché il mio corpo è spento.
Yes, this is... Yeah, of course, darling. This is why we understand the Vajrayana model. It's very helpful. We're going to discuss the death process, which is very helpful to understand. And this is the basis of the... This is coming from the Vajrayana, the most advanced teachings. And this is also the basis of the Tibetan medical system. So we talk about this gross consciousness, which is inextricably linked with this gross body. And that's our sensory consciousness and all the way we live day to day. That's the gross level. And that's all we posit as existing in our culture, isn't it? Because that's where your brain is functioning. So obviously, when you go to sleep, that has stopped. When or to some degree, when you're under anaesthetic, it's the same. So there are reports of people like you. You know, in that book I mentioned briefly when I was editing Lama Zopa's book about death, this man, this medical journalist, he had a whole chapter on people who have these experiences while they're on the operating table. They're observing exactly what happens. Is that what you did? You were observing what happened. But you don't feel it because, you see, that's the next level of your consciousness is called subtle consciousness. And that's when we dream, that's when we're in a coma, and that's also in situations like that. And that is not connected to your brain and your nervous system. So many people have the experience of floating above and watching it. But that's your subtle consciousness. And you haven't left, they call it out of body, but you haven't left your body. But that's the experience of a subtle consciousness. Now, when we've got single-pointed concentration, we have learned to access a relatively subtle level of mind, and that's the level of mind that can see long distances, that can be clairvoyant, in other words. And that level does not need a brain. This is our subtle consciousness. And this is very common. This is not an uncommon experience, a very common one. One experience I had, which wasn't exactly like that, but it's an example. During a retreat I did in Tushita years ago when I first became a nun, it was a 3-month retreat, and I had a very vivid experience. We'd have our sleep at two, we'd have a nap, to a siesta, you know, at 2 o'clock. And then for a couple of weeks, I had these crystal clear dreams, vivid, like as if it was real life, crystal clear, but at the same time, I could hear all the talking around the building. I could hear everybody. I couldn't see, but I could hear. That's subtle consciousness. That's our capability. Some people have it all the time. Some people just have it occasionally. And this is where the interesting point about the death process. I don't know. I mentioned that example of the person, the heartbeat. Did I mention that story? There's an interesting point about the death process and the thing of giving organs. You know how that's... Lama Zopa praises that and says it's marvelous a person wants to give their heart or give their liver after they've died. But what they do is, and this book was showing all the contradictions and problems with this because he was reporting all these experiences of people observing their operation, of people coming back to life, which is fitting with the Buddhist view. So one thing he reported... One woman who's giving her one of her organs. So when you stop breathing, they keep you breathing. They keep you alive artificially. So, of course, they think you're dead. But as Lama Zopa says, of course, you're not dead. Your subtle mind is still there, the subtle mind. The gross mind has stopped, but subtle mind is still there. So what happened was she was on the operating table, and then the nurse who was monitoring the computer that showed the heartbeat said as soon as they got the circular saw to cut her from head to toe to cut out her organs, she observed that the heart went from 100 to 200 beats a minute. So as the author said, I wonder what a dead person has to worry about. But this fits perfectly with the Buddhist view in exactly the same way that you can observe what's happening while you're unconscious. Even when you're dead, not dead yet, your subtle mind is still there. She had exactly that experience probably. And so she observed that they were cutting her open. She knew she wasn't dead yet, so she freaked out. And so that's not a good way to die. And it's really quite a difficulty, this business of organs. But that's exactly the same kind of experience. That's, you know, that's explaining that. So it's interesting you had the experience. Did you tell people later? Did you tell people later? Did you tell your doctor? Did you tell your doctor? Speak in the microphone. Speak in the microphone.
Il dottore mi ha detto che mi ha dato due medicinali, uno che paralizzava e l'altro che addormentava.
They said that the doctor gave her two kind of medication, one that was paralyzing the body.
Yes. Yes, right. Yes.
Penso che l'assunzione dal mio corpo è stata diversa nel tempo, per cui
the body got the effect of this medicine.
Yes, right. But did you tell your doctor later what happened? Your experience?
Sì, sì, lui mi ha dato questa spiegazione a
fronte di questa esperienza.
What? What's that got to do with it?
The doctor told her this explanation of the...
But why is that an explanation? But why is that an explanation? It's not an explanation. What?
He said that this was a different reaction of the medicine.
Oh, that's, of course he'd think that. He wouldn't know anything else, would he? Anyway, that's okay. Whatever. This is the Buddhist explanation. This is the Buddhist explanation, okay? You can decide which one you prefer. Okay, nothing wrong. Any other questions, people? See? Tony, hello.
Hello, and thank you for your teaching.
Okay.
I would like to go back to you and Ron.
Okay, good.
As an example, could be you in your job that you don't like.
That's right, yes.
How is correct to think in terms of breaking the circle? Let's stay on you and Ron. Mm. Ron is no good with you, and you work on yourself in order to create the barrier, as you were explaining, and not taking it personally. So then you go back and you try again with Ron, but Ron keep doing this. Mm. So it creates like a circle.
Okay, no. I said the way to put it is this. You know, if I'm in a relationship with Ron or I'm at the job, same thing, and I find it difficult. Ron becomes difficult. Let's say he's abusive and he cheats on me and whatever. So at some point, I've got some choices to make. I think this is the point. Often when we're feeling like a victim, we never get to the point where we act. We just stay angry, we stay hurt, we stay jealous, so we become paralyzed. So we have to make choices, and that's when we start to become powerful. So I've got two choices only. One is leave him. One is to stay. So if the reason to stay isn't just to be a martyr, and it isn't to make him change, the reason to stay, and this is a very powerful practice, is if I feel there's some value in our relationship, I feel there's something worthwhile there, I feel there's some benefit there. Maybe there could be lots of reasons. Could be lots of reasons. But if I make that decision, that's very powerful, then that means I don't expect him to change. That's not what the issue is. This is very powerful. My friend who has the alcoholic husband, she had to make a choice at some point. She could see, she accepted he wasn't going to change. And that's what attachment. Attachment always thinks, maybe he'll change. If only he'll change, I'll get him to change. It manipulates. She had to realize this is who he is. He could change later, but to stop expecting him to change. So then she decided decided. She weighed up the options. The children loved him. He's very patient. He's very generous. He's very kind. He doesn't vomit in the soup. He's an alcoholic. He drinks 4 bottles of beer every evening. He's now retired under the tree with his dog. Then he goes and has his dinner every night and 3 bottles of red wine, and he goes to bed. He doesn't abuse anybody. So she made up her decision. The kids love him. The grandkids love him. He's generous. She has her own Buddhist practice. She goes to her retreats. She's happy. She stopped being angry, and she stopped wanting him to be different. That's the point. That's the tough practice. That's what my friends in prison do. So if I feel there's no reason to be in the relationship and there's no value for me, or I can't cope, by Ron, I'm out of here. And that's a tough decision too. If we've got to make a decision, and when we're angry and frustrated and jealous, there's no decisions. We become paralyzed. That's the nightmare. That's the victim mind. Do you understand? You've got to weigh up what's best. But stop expecting him to be different. You know? And leaving is a very wise decision. And many people, it's a very intelligent decision. But our trouble is in our culture, because we've kind of got the Christian view that it's a sin to not be forever. So we have this idea that it's sort of wrong to leave a relationship. That's just ridiculous. The Buddhist view, that's foolish. Karma finishes. And it's intelligent to leave. If you can't handle it, leave and make the most of your life. Bye, Ron, but don't blame Ron. Just say you can't cope. This is powerful. Either way, the real one is to make decisions, to choose. And with my friends in prison, they don't have that luxury, but they choose. They decided, I can't leave prison, so I'll learn to accept it and see it as good. That's pretty powerful. Do you understand my point? And as soon as we start choosing, then we start to change. I mean, even just now, you know, people email me and ask me advice, so I do my best. And one person whose typical story, had a husband for 20 years. She thought it was a wonderful marriage. She lent him all this money. She supported his education. She looked after him. He was an immigrant from another country. She spent thousands of dollars. They had 2 children. She thought it was the best relationship. Then she discovered he's been cheating on her for years. He really hates her, and now he's abusing her. And she's just full of rage and despair. She can't make any, she's divorced him even, but she's still full of anger. So she can't move until she starts getting past that anger. That's how we all are. And that's how most of us stay. We stay in the anger. We stay in the blame. We stay in the jealousy, and we go mad. Do you see? This is why it's so hard to practice. Do you understand? Yeah. And the point for Max, the big point, which I didn't finish. Everybody, when we hear karma, like you're hearing, and we're hearing about suffering, we only hear karma in terms of bad things. And I always say this. So if you just say, you know, when you, for example, worrying about the people who've done something bad and now they're suffering, which sounds very shocking. But what about this scenario? In other words, no one ever asks me this question. So, you know, you just say you hear about this little girl who's got a wonderful father and a wonderful mother, and there's money in the bank, and she has a good education, this kid, and she's got a lovely grandparents, and everybody loves her, and she's got a good education. And you say, you mean Rabina, she deserves that? Nobody ever asked that question, because we think we deserve good, but we don't think we deserve bad. So when we hear about a child being abused and harmed, it's so shocking to hear that she created the cause to have it. But when good things happen, we never ask, you mean she deserves that? Well, yes, she does. It's the fruit of her virtue. So when you understand that botany refers to flowers and weeds, Max, but we only hear it in terms of judgment and bad, that's because we have ego grasping. And we take all our good for granted. We don't even bother to ask, what are the cause of all the good things that happened to me? That's the arrogance of attachment, because we just assume we deserve it, which is unbelievable ignorance. So any good thing that we've ever had happen to us, we absolutely deserve it. We created the cause by our past generosity, past morality, and past goodness. And if we thought about karma like that, we would be blissful. And then we could own the bad things without effort. Do you hear me? This is profound. That has to help your mind. Yes? Good. Very happy. I remember giving a talk in Miami years ago, and there was me. The topic was, why do bad things happen to good people? And there was me, a Lutheran, a Catholic, and a rabbi. Sounds like a joke, doesn't it? So the topic was, why do bad things happen? So it was easy for me. I just talked about karma, you know. I didn't understand the Catholic, and I didn't understand the Lutheran. But the rabbi clapped. He said, we have the same view. He was a Kabbalah rabbi. And he said, he talked about karma, and he's cracking jokes about Hitler. I mean, the Jews in the audience were shocked. They'd never heard this before. So he said, we have a saying. Every time something bad happens, we go, great, one less debt to repay. Isn't it interesting? He was very wonderful. Let's continue with these intense verses, okay? So the third one is about the mind, mostly. And this is already implies, again, if you analyze the words carefully, it implies a really advanced practitioner. So he's basically saying the moment you notice a negative thought pop up in your mind, you quickly avert it. Why? Because it harms you and it harms others. I mean, that's incredible. The assumption here for this person is that the default mode for them is virtuous thoughts. And a naughty negative thought pops up and you quickly change it. Well, I mean, it's the opposite for us, with all respect to us. Our default mode is unhappy thoughts and worry and fear and guilt and anxiety. I mean, I never hear a person say, I can't stop thinking good thoughts. Nobody ever says that. Do you understand? Because all the negative ones loom large and we make them worse than they are. But they're always the anxious, worried ones, the fearful ones, you know. So the thing is, this implies this guy's got to have single point of concentration, and he's probably got to have bodhicitta as well. So we do our best, okay, to attempt to notice our thoughts. I mean, this is huge. So the next three are really kind of intense, you know. And each one gets worse than the next. So this fourth one, verse 4, and I mentioned it before. Whenever you look at the world and you see all the psychopaths, we use that term in Italian, right? You say the psychopaths, right? Isn't it? Kind of a colloquial term we use for crazy people. Yes? You say that? Yes, you do. Psychopaths. Right, okay. It's a good term. I mean, we mean the real crazies, the psychopaths, the craziness, the rapists, the murderers, the terrorists, the bomb throwers, the torturers, you know? I mean, I've got a friend on death row in Kentucky who's a Buddhist, amazing guy, Mitch. I'm ready for that electric jolt, he said. You know, he's getting ready for his death date. He's a Buddhist. So he said, there's one guy there I know, he comes to the talks I give. He said, Rabina, he thinks of torture all the time. This is where, when we understand karma in junior school, and we understand how we come into this life programmed with our own tendencies, and then we hear about other people with crazy tendencies, the wish to kill and the pedophiles and the amazing, you know, if we don't have the view of karma, there is no way to comprehend, there is no way you can describe why they think this way. Equally, there is no way we can describe, you know, and you go on YouTube and you see 7-year-old girls writing pieces for 50-piece orchestras. You see 5-year-old girls playing Bach. There's no way to explain that either. So karma, at least, is an explanation of conscious not being physical. Everything we think and do and say leaves seeds in the mind, program us, and we come into this life with a bunch of tendencies. Well, that at least has an explanation for why you're a psychopath since you're a little boy, or why you play Bach since you're a little girl, or why you're Mother Teresa. At least it's an explanation, you know. So when you know about your own delusions in grade in junior school, you know about your own neuroses and your own anger and your own hurt and your own jealousy and your own despair, and you know those are your tendencies and you see how much they cause you suffering and you see how they cause you to harm others, now you can begin to understand a pedophile. You can begin to understand a psychopath. It's logic. But if you have the view that your mother made you and you can't see what happened, you look back at the mothers of this psychopath and you can't see they did anything wrong, then we're just mystified. We don't know why there's a psychopath. Where did this come from? Nobody knows. And then, of course, we think it's so shocking and they're monsters and how dare they, and we wish they'd rather just die and go to hell or something, you know. We don't have an explanation. We can't blame God for it. So at least karma for yourself, it explains it. And now we're seeing others. And we know we suffer because of our attachment and our anger. We suffer and we harm others. So now we know they're even more intense, the crazies, you know. So when you see them, and they're not rare. In our world these days, they are not rare. Back in 10th century Tibet, maybe they were rare. Come on, you know. overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering. This is the point. But you won't know that until you know for yourself, your own mind, your own suffering, at whatever level. You won't understand it until you understand karma for yourself. And the practice is, I will hold these dear, hold them close, have affection for them, as if I had found a precious treasure. So what, again, is the logic of that? Don't just hear it as religious poetry, you know? What's the logic of that thought? Why would you hold dear a psychopath? Why would you think you had found a precious treasure? It's really logical. The job we're doing here, the bottom line, the job we're doing here is smashing ego grasping and attachment and the other disturbing emotions. That's our job. This is an intense level of doing that. So just like, you know, you always read about all these intense sportsmen. I always read about, like, I always remember, what's his name? That cyclist. He was naughty. Lance Armstrong. For me, he was like a real fanatic sportsman, wasn't he? I know he's naughty now, but when you read about him, people admire his they did admire his incredible extreme effort. Think of my point. People admired he would push himself to the limit. So he loved the high mountains. He didn't want to ride down. That's too easy. The more the mountain was tough, the higher the mountain, the better the challenge. That's his view. That's the one that he wanted. Why? Because that forced him to become the best cyclist. Same here. The more problems you have out there, the more difficulty, the more the crazies, the more violence, the more negative, the more this is testing your own ego grasping. It is testing your attachment, and it is smashing it. That's the high mountains for the bodhisattvas. Can you see what I'm saying? This is the logic of it. But our trouble is, when we hear compassion, we think, oh, the poor thing, look at their suffering. They can't help it, the poor thing. That's naive and childish compassion. This compassion has got iron and strength in it because it's based on karma, and understanding the mind. So if you met the pedophile, you wouldn't just pat him on the head and say, the poor fellow. You'd protect him from himself and put him in prison. No doubt, if he's going to run around torturing people. My friend in prison on death row who thinks of torture all day, I'm not glad he's on death row, but I'm glad he's out of the way of harming people for his sake. You protect people from their own craziness. That's compassion, not sentimental compassion. That's why we have to understand people's minds. And you cannot understand people's minds until you understand yours in high school and understand karma in junior school. Next one, even heavier. This is like the world. You read the papers and you learn about these guys. Now it gets closer to home. This is more like, I think, at work. Think about this. When out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, criticize me, harm me. We all know that. You get bad-mouthed at work. People accuse you of doing something you didn't do. You get fired. The pain is terrible. We all understand this. I'll accept the defeat and offer the victory to them. This is outrageous. This is shocking. This is so intense. Try it once a year. It's really powerful. Everybody has criticism. Everybody has people who don't like them. Everybody has people who criticize them, badmouth them behind their back, accuse them of doing things. Every one of us in this room has had that experience. And we know the hurt, especially if we did nothing wrong. It's so painful. This is unbelievably powerful practice. But you've got to be a suitable vessel. If I'm still the victim in Ron's relationship, I am not. This is not my job. Hit me again, Ron. No. Get out. You've got to know where you're at, what you can handle. So I always quote this story too. Same little story. Must get new stories. Years ago, a friend of mine in Sydney, one of the students of Lama Zopa, was at a party of a bunch of Buddhists. And the guy whose party it was, John or somebody, he was telling about how his brand new BMW had been scratched right along the door. So he got a new door, and then it got scratched again. His new BMW got scratched along the door. Okay. So then it happened again. And then a third time, I think. And he said, what'll I do, you know? He discovered the old guy next door was scratching his BMW. So obviously this old guy next door thought that John had done something wrong. I mean, you know, it's crazy. John had done nothing wrong. So, you know, different people said different things. Well, you know, scratch his car, sue him, whatever. And George said, I'll tell you what Lama Zopa would do. He would find out what this old guy liked, and then he would buy him a beautiful gift, and he would apologize. I mean, this is not normal behavior, is it? So this John thought this was great. So he discovered this old guy liked golf. He bought beautiful golf balls, wrapped them beautifully, went next door, offered them to him, and apologized for anything he'd done wrong. He'd done nothing wrong. So then John went back to the kitchen, had a cup of tea, and felt like he'd finished the job. He was happy. And the old guy knocked on the door with his gift unwrapped, beaming from ear to ear. Thank you so much. How kind you've been. No one's been so kind. And he said, everything is forgiven. You know? I mean, these simple stories, so outrageous. You hear many stories. I remember reading in different papers, especially in America, they're crazy. Like one story of these two mega rich guys, billionaires, who live in some fancy place out of New York somewhere. And it's all a big argument started like 25 years ago over some kind of the trash can put too far over to the wrong side. Something like this. So 25 years later, they spent millions of dollars in court. It's got to the point where they're, I mean, just unbelievable nightmare. Each accusing the other, and it escalated. Because no one would just accept the defeat, you know. This is how wars start, and then karmically it's how wars start. Next life. Unbelievable. This is profound. This is an outrageous practice. But you've got to be ready to be able to do this. It's so brave to do this. It's so powerful to do this. So start with the little things. When someone accuses you of breaking the cup. Yeah, you're right, I'm so sorry. That's just a quick, powerful, that's like an atomic bomb, you know. On ego and on attachment. Just to accept. Yep, you're right, I'm so sorry. Not passive aggressive. It's so hard though, because instinctively, even if we did do something wrong, we can hardly own it. So when we didn't do it, it's like weird, you know. But such a powerful practice. And obviously you've got to really work on your mind to be able to do it. You've got to be very courageous. The third one is the closest to home. This is the most unbearable. This is like your wife. This is your husband. This is your daughter. Someone whom I've benefited and in whom I have great hopes. That sounds like your child to me. Harms me terribly. So common story in these days. I'll regard that person as my holy guru, you know. It's just a variation on the theme, basically. The practice each time. I'll hold them all as most dear. I'll see them as the supreme. You know. As if I'd found a precious treasure. I'll offer the victory. I'll regard them as my guru. Each practice, simple examples of variations, simple examples of scenarios we all recognize in our life and using it to completely interpret it differently. Just like that woman in prison. I decided I am not a prisoner. I am a monk. I am not in a cell. I am in a cave. I mean, it could be a verse in this thing, you know. Unbelievable. And the interesting point, by the way, for me, like I said it before, the added point that's interesting about that woman, as opposed to the other guy who went crazy, which we think is normal, because she was able to see it differently and, like, you know, see it differently, and therefore she grew internally, but she kept her sanity. So she was able to work on her freedom. She didn't give up. She didn't go, oh, well, I'm in prison. Why? Who cares? No, she never stopped working on her freedom. And because she wasn't out of her brain with rage, she had the ability to do that, and she finally got free anyway. I bet the other guy didn't. He didn't know, because he just went mad. When you're angry, you can do nothing. You're paralyzed. This is why this really is, forget this one. Even what that woman did was practical. It's not moralistic. It's not heavy. It's practical. But it's very hard because we've got disturbing emotions, misconceptions, and because of karma. And that's why it's so fascinating. It proves the point I made before about the assumption of attachment, believing we deserve good things. We never, ever, ever, and no one ever, ever in all my years of doing this job has ever asked me the question, why do good things happen? Surely that's a bit judgmental, Rabina. People might be upset if they're getting good things happen because they've been such good people. Max. It's an interesting point, isn't it? It's fascinating. No one has ever asked that question. In fact, I said it one time to one guy and he literally couldn't hear it. Because we so assume good things are normal and we deserve good and you don't ask why. We just greedily want more of it. That's the depth of attachment. And the depth and the rage of anger is how dare that happen to me. And then, of course, as Max is pointing out, which is a view of karma, we hear it that way, that it sounds terrible. It sounds like brutal judgment and punishment. I remember in England years ago, I think the manager of the English soccer team, he cracked a joke about karma and somebody being in a wheelchair. He said it was a result of negative karma. They fired him from the job because they considered he was so shocking in his judgment. Do you understand? Interesting, isn't it? We can't bear to hear it. You're right, Max. You're so right. And because we're used to thinking of it as punishment from God. We hear it in exactly the same way. Hell is a place created to send people to suffer. That's how we've heard it. That's how we believe. So it's hard to hear the karmic one as it's presented. Do you understand, Max? It really takes thinking. Some people who are Buddhists don't even want to think about karma. A group of Buddhists I know, somewhere, doesn't matter where, they're social worker Buddhists and they're wonderful. They do a beautiful job helping people. They never talk about karma because they're embarrassed. They think it's judgment. They don't want to upset people. Do you understand? I just think, what the hell? Talk about it. I'm happy to talk about the hell realms as well. I don't mind. We're big girls and boys. We're brave enough. We can handle it, Max. Do you understand? Because Buddha's either right or he's wrong. I don't care. If he's wrong, I'm happy. And if he's right, I'm happy. Either way, you win, you know. Doesn't matter. We're big girls and boys. So then verse 7, this is the source of Tonglen, I'd say, isn't it? Verse 7, it's the source of that practice, Tonglen, which people love in the West. It's so fascinating. People love this practice. As it says here, you know, in short, both directly and indirectly, I offer every happiness, my happiness, and benefit. I offer all my good things to my mothers. And I secretly take upon myself all their suffering. So that, as we know, has been formalized in a meditation technique. Tonglen, giving, taking. And this is where, you know, it's an attitude to develop in your life every second, but you can do it in a formal meditation. And I know I've noticed so many people in the West love this meditation, which I think is amazing. It's incredible. I'm very amazed by that. So basically you visualize, there's many ways you can do it. You visualize a person in front of you who's sick, for example, like your friend with a headache. And what you're doing in the meditation, first you visualize breathing in all their suffering. And the attitude is, I would rather have it than them. You hear mothers and fathers talk that way about their suffering of their children. I wish I could have it. You hear the people say that. It's incredible. One of my friends in prison, it blew my mind, you know. This Mexican guy, ex-gangster, who's killed several people. He's in prison for life. He's been practicing all these years. I've known him 25 years. Richie. When I first heard from him, he was a friend of the very first guy, Arturo, and then he wrote a letter, and he'd been talking to Arturo, and he'd been listening, trying to meditate. And he told me about, in his letter, he told me how angry he was. He said, I'm a very laid-back guy, but when I get angry, I get very angry. So anyways, he'd been in gangs, so I met him for the first time after a year of writing to him, and there he was, there's glass between us, we're on the phone, you know, he's in top security, and he's covered in tattoos, and the tattoos, they tell me, this is 25 years ago. Things are changing a lot in California now. I've heard that many people who've had life sentences are getting out. They're changing, mostly because they're overcrowded and they can't handle it, you know, and they can't afford it. But anyway, Richie, covered in tattoos, he said, and all the gangsters, they say their tattoos are all prison art. They make their own needles, they make their own, they do their own, they create their own lettering and they do their own tattoos, you know. Anyway, there he was, covered in tattoos. And I said to him, he told me in his letter he's angry. I said, how's your anger, Richie? So he kind of blushed under his tattoos. And he said, Rabin, I have to confess, I had a fight with my cellie. In California, your cellmate is called your cellie. I had a fight with my cellie this morning, and I put his head down the toilet. But then he said, very innocently, but Rabina, I took it out again. I was so blown out, I could not believe it. And I figured, well, that's good, he didn't kill a fourth person. That's practice, you know. Then he had the guy thrown out of his cell, and he sat down and did his Tara meditation. These Mexicans love Tara, you know. That's practice. That's pretty powerful. Anyway, Richie one time wrote, and he said that he was very moved. He said, all my people, I mean the Mexicans, all my people coming into prison, and these young guys, you know, they're even tried as adults when they're 15 and 16. So he said, I wish I could take upon myself their sentencing and they could leave prison. I mean, just that thought. That's Tong Len, you know, that's incredible. It was unbelievable. And he said also in the letter, he said he had HIV, not HIV, but he had some liver problem, like a very common, you know. And he said, I've got medicine. The state is giving him medicine. He said, perhaps I shouldn't take the medicine and I should die, and then I can purify all my negative karma. What do you think, Rabina? I mean, that's profound, you know. I was so moved by that. Anyway. What am I saying here? Tong Len. Okay. So Tong Len is you visualize. Okay, before we even talk about that, let's look at the levels of compassion. Levels of compassion. Compassion in general is, as I said, starts with a thought, the concept, may you not suffer. That's the fundamental of what compassion is. May you see someone suffering, you feel their pain, you have empathy, and you wish they didn't suffer. That's compassion. Of course, you can grow it hugely. Flip that over, you have love. May you be happy. May you be happy, you know. So that's compassion. So if you're on the Hinayana path, if you're on junior school and high school, the Theravadan path, that's the component of the Lam Rim that's shared by the people practicing in Burma and Thailand. But if you're on that path there, they will graduate at high school. They say most people don't have the karma to be born, to become Buddhas, but you can get out of samsara, you can become your own, you can be liberated from suffering. So that means you do all the same practices we've discussed, abide by the laws of karma, live in vows, you go to high school, you get shamatha, you work on your mind, you get renunciation, and then eventually you realize emptiness, you practice realizing emptiness. And then eventually in one life or other, you achieve your nirvana, your cessation of suffering, and when you die, you don't come back. So what would you be like if you had just accomplished that? What would you be like if you'd become liberated from suffering and its causes? Well, you can't imagine how such a powerful person. There would be no ego grasping left. There is no attachment. There is no anger. There is no depression. There's no anxiety. All the delusions, all the disturbing emotions have gone. This is what Buddha says we can accomplish. So how do you think you'd be? You wouldn't just sit there kind of bored. You'd be full of the virtuous qualities. Not nearly as much as the bodhisattva, that's for sure. But you would have only love, only compassion, only empathy. You'd be a blissful, radiant, marvelous person. And you would have compassion. How could you not have? They're at the core of your being. You can never get rid of them. But what's the difference between that compassion and the compassion of the bodhisattva path? That's called great compassion. Mahakaruna, great compassion. So it's like, compassion is, oh my God, look at that suffering. This is unbearable. That's compassion. But this next one, which is the unique characteristic of the bodhisattva compassion, the unique one that you need to carry on, to move, to grow, to continue, to get to bodhicitta. This goes, what can I do to fix it? What can I do to help? That's great compassion. This is the kind of the brave attitude of the bodhisattva who takes the responsibility. That's the whole way they talk about the bodhisattva, isn't it? As this brave attitude that it's my job. It's my job. Like a mother. That's exactly what a mother's like. She sees her baby drowning. She will have unbelievable compassion. She won't sit there wondering who's going to save her baby. She's in that water whether she can swim or not. That's great compassion. That's the one we have to cultivate. And that's the difference. So what happens is, if you're on the Mahayana path, you're going through the same stages as the junior school and high school, speaking simply. But you're on that path, and you're not on the Mahayana. You're on that path. And your goal, this is the other point, your goal is nirvana. Your goal is your own nirvana, your own cessation of suffering, your liberation. That's your goal. That every life after life, that's your motivation, your powerful motivation based on renunciation to get the hell out of samsara. That's your goal. Then you get to the point in as you're progressing in your path, you get more love, more compassion, more joy, more bliss, more marvelous qualities. And at some point in that life, whichever life it is, you completely cut everything. But then when you get to death, because of your motivation to get out of samsara, that overrides all your compassion. That overrides, and then the bliss, they override your compassion and you zap off and don't come back. If you're on the Mahayana path, your goal is Buddhahood. So you could even get to a point where you don't need to come back at some point. But because you've got this compassion, maybe bodhicitta by this point, you will not come back. You will come back out of choice because of this great compassion. And that, of course, culminates in bodhicitta. So Tonglen is this powerful, radical, ridiculous practice that increases your compassion so powerfully, you know. So it's sort of like compassion is, oh my God, look at my friend, she's got a headache. The next one is, what can I do to help? What can I do to help? The next one is, you know what, honey, I can handle it. Give it to me, rather me than you. That's Tonglen. So it's a really courageous one. Now, the thing is, there are many misunderstandings about what Tonglen is. It is not a healing technique. There are lots of healing techniques. Pray to the medicine Buddha, much more powerful. You're not trying to get rid of their headache. This is not a healing technique. This is specifically for you to smash ego grasping, to smash attachment, so you can cultivate profound compassion to finally get bodhicitta. It's for you. You're the beneficiary of this. So second, it is not, you're not trying to get a headache. That's a joke. What time's dinner? 7? 7:30, okay. You're not trying to get a headache. That's ridiculous. It's got nothing to do with it. So what you're trying to do is imagine that if you could, you would rather have this headache than this person. So you practice visualizing it, imagining it's like this yucky smoke, taking the headache off them, being so happy they're free of suffering. And you imagine breathing it in. There's all different ways you can visualize. And you can, like, for example, that little rock at your heart, you're self-cherishing, and you imagine smashing that. And then you breathe out blissful light. You breathe out all your good things, giving them your wealth, your merit, your happiness, and imagine them having it. That's the practice of love. The first one is the practice of compassion. The second one is the practice of love, giving them happiness. That's Tonglen. And then that culminates in bodhicitta eventually. But we're going to go through the stages. We'll do that tomorrow. We've got tonight as well. What do we do tonight? Maybe we'll do purification tonight. What do you think? Should we do purification tonight? Four opponent powers? You're doing okay? It's not too exhausting? Huh? You're all right? You okay, Ron?
Yes.
You're being a good boy? Okay. It's only 7:10. Any questions? We can finish soon. We have to be 7:30. We can finish soon. Any questions about this idea of compassion, the 8 verses, Tonglen, blah, blah, blah? Yes. No. Giuseppe, go on.
Microphone.
See, coming. Yes, Giuseppe.
Okay. My question is, how would you respond to a question like, isn't it more effective doing extra practical things?
What, darling? What, say that again, Giuseppe.
To do practical things instead of visualizing, instead of trying and imagining a positive thing.
So, Giuseppe.
I'm
Cut to the chase.
I think about when we, for example, we...
Can you cut to the chase? Do you know what cut to the chase means? Can you ask me a question?
Yes.
Don't give too much background. Just ask me a question.
Okay. When we meditate about compassion...
Ask me a question.
Wouldn't it be more effective to do practical things?
Okay. Okay, that means you don't get it at all. It means you're not understanding Giuseppe. God. That's like saying you're sitting there learning to be a doctor. It's a 7-year course. And you're sitting there and you're reading all these books about how to help. And you're reading all the books and you're reading all the books and you're learning how to be a good surgeon. And I say to you, what are you doing with your nose in a book? Why aren't you out there helping people, being practical? And you say to me, Rabina, don't be stupid. I have to learn how to be practical. I have to learn how to help. You're learning to be a surgeon. You can't just walk in the surgery and start cutting legs off. You have to learn it by studying and practicing. That's what these practices are. Then you can do very practical things. This is the whole point of doing it, Giuseppe. You're training. A bodhisattva is a trainee Buddha. And by doing all these practices, they are smashing the obstacles and they are becoming perfected. Then you are able to do the practical thing. That's the point, sweetheart. Thank you. Meanwhile, you do what level you can. You don't just wait till you're a perfect surgeon. You give band-aids. You do what you can. But you keep learning more. This is the whole point. So I'll tell you a story, which is where you can see the culmination of these practices. Our friend Harry, I always tell this story too. I've told it so many times. An American. People say, oh, Harry's a bodhisattva, you know, Harry's a bodhisattva. I don't know. I know he's a nice guy. He looks like Father Christmas. He's fat with a big beard, you know. Yeah, I saw him in Koh Phan recently. Anyway, the point is, and he's a jolly, friendly fellow. What you see is a jolly, friendly fellow. He's always there helping. He does the dishes. He sweeps the floor. Everybody thinks that they're his best friend because he's kind to everybody, you know. So what you see is a lovely fellow. Well, who knows if he's a bodhisattva, but this story tells me he must be. Okay. So he told me this story years ago. I'd heard it from someone else. Then he verified the story for me. I wanted the facts about it. And it's not showing off. I think it's profound to hear this story and to take it as an example of the result of meditation, the result. He's got a cave up in Solokumbu, where Lama Zopa's cave is. He's got a cave. He's meditated up there for many years. Now he's meditating somewhere in Lama Zopa's place in America. Anyway, the point is, the story goes like this. He's at Koh Phan 1 year, and he's getting ready to go up to his cave to meditate. And Lama Zopa said he had a dream that Harry would die, so to tell him not to go. So anyway, this is just, I think this is my added comment here. Lama Zopa doesn't sleep, so he can't have been dreaming. It was his clairvoyance, you know. So he's just being humble. So anyway, they couldn't get a message to Harry because Harry had left. And obviously it's before mobile phones, so it couldn't get the message. So then Lama Zopa said to Geshe Lama Khonchog, who was there, this amazing yogi who lived up in the mountains, as I mentioned him before, no food, no sleep, you know. Lama Zopa said he lived in Vajrayogini's Pure Land. Amazing, wonderful yogi. So he said, he asked him to pray for Harry. So this is the story. So Harry was walking up the mountain, you know, and it's very treacherous up there. And he told me at some point, one of the main roads was cut off and they had to take this extra thin, very narrow, very dangerous, high up, small, narrow pass. And people always fall off. The yaks fall off, you know, people fall off. I've done an advertisement now. I've got 4 advertisements and I'll sneak them in. So I've got a CD and a DVD I'm going to have selling in the shop, and I'll talk about those later. But there's 2 postcards you're going to see. One is advertising a trek to Lama Zopa's cave. I've been doing it now for 3 years, and it raises money for Rinpoche's cave up there. He has this amazing plan to build a replica of Guru Rinpoche's Pure Land, an actual building up there. It's 4,500 metres above Kathmandu. So anyway, I've never walked up a mountain in my whole life, but I agreed to lead this trek, and I can't believe myself. But I'm doing another one in October. So anyway, walking up there, it is very treacherous, I tell you. I mean, I nearly got knocked over by a yak. So anyway, the story is Harry is walking up this path. He's got his pack on his back, like 25 kilos or something on his back, you know, and he's walking slowly. And I think a nun was with him, and she must have told the story first. So he's He's walking up, and suddenly he's on this very narrow path, and these four Sherpas are walking down, these four porters. Well, these porters, I know from our experience, these young kids with their flip-flops, you know, they're walking up these mountains, and they're carrying 60 kilos on their backs. You can't believe them, you know. They're unbelievable, and they're bent over, and all you do is you see your feet. On these really treacherous paths, you really have to have incredible concentration, and if you get distracted, you're over the mountain, you know. So these four Sherpas coming down was very intense, very quick, very close. And the first thing that Harry said to himself, okay, four of them, one of me, I'll step to the side. So in all these teachings, which we'll go into, all these different techniques you use for your own mind to try to cut self-cherishing. The thing is, in the wisdom wing, as we've talked, the main problem is called attachment. And everything in the wisdom wing is in reference to how to cut attachment, because that's the enemy. That's the problem. But in the compassion wing, it's framed differently. It's called self-cherishing, or as we would simply say, selfishness, putting me first. So it kind of sounds very brutal. If someone accuses you of being very selfish, you feel kind of bad, you know? Self-centered. Me first. That's naturally the consequence of having attachment. It's naturally the consequence of having ego grasping. So it's framed in the compassion wing as trying to reverse. We want to make this paradigm shift from cherishing me to cherishing others. So all the techniques in the compassion wing, and we'll go through these. We've just ended up with Tonglen, which is the last one, but we'll go through the other techniques and get there. They're all framed in terms of smashing, getting rid of cherishing me and putting others first. So there's all these different approaches that you can take. And they say one of the ways to start doing that is you think, well, for example, I'm one person and there's four people. Well, four is more than one. Well, four are more important. I mean, ego doesn't want to think that. It's hilarious. So the first thing that arose in his mind. So now, think of this first, before we say any more. That's not natural. As we would call natural, it's to be self-cherishing. It's to put me first. And of course, because he's practiced, that's why he can think that. So he spent years in his cave meditating on these things, Giuseppe. That's exactly what he's done. Now he's proving the point. Now this is the proof of the pudding. You say that in Italian? The proof of the pudding? Now it's the real taste, the real exam. Now it's the proof that he can do it. He studied to be a surgeon. Now he can do the surgery. He studied to be all these things meditating in his cave. Now the example comes and now he can actually do it. So he put himself to the edge of the cliff, right? That's kind of crazy. Then the next thought, because the path was so narrow and so treacherous, he then said to himself, if they knock me, I won't hold on. Now, there's no way in the world, unless they were your beloved babies, that you would think that thought. They're strangers. So this is the proof, exactly my point. He has spent years and years and years doing these meditations until they became genuine experiences, Giuseppe. And now comes the example, and now he can do it without effort. Do you hear my point? Without practicing for years and years, how could you just be like that? Impossibility. That's the power of meditation. It's not just being self-centered. He's actually changing his mind. So here he is. He sat at the edge of the cliff. His feet are on the cliff. The cliff is behind him. He's got his pack on his back, and they knock him. They don't mean to. It's treacherous. It's very difficult, and they knock him, and he doesn't hold on. And his feet are on the ground, and he told me he's starting to fall. His pack is pulling him. He said, I had a psychic vision of the entire fall. I saw my body crash to the ground. Then he said, as he's falling, his feet are on the ground, I felt the hands of Geshe Lama Khontrog forcefully pushing me, and he reversed direction and he fell into the Sherpas. So there's several teachings in that. First is, there is no way in the universe he could do that if he hadn't practiced in his cave for years, doing all these intense practices, literally transforming his mind first in meditation. It is not possible. You can't suddenly become a surgeon by just looking at somebody. You can't suddenly play Bach without practicing 8 hours a day. You can't suddenly do that level of actual practical practice without having meditated for years and realizing emptiness and achieving bodhicitta. Do you understand? This is obvious. You sort of know it, you know, you've studied. And then the other teaching, of course, is the power of the holy beings. And he had the merit. So that's clearly bodhicitta. He was able to actually do what he'd meditated on all these years. It's the proof of it, you know. It wasn't just intellectual. That's actual experience. And then he had the power to be saved by a Buddha, you know, because of his own karma. He created the cause for that. He created the cause. The Buddhas can do that for all of us. We don't have the merit. We had created and created the cause, you know. So that's a very powerful story. I like that story. So we do our best. Trying to, you know, take on the suffering of others. Take the blame. See others as higher. See ourselves as lower. Do our best. One step at a time, you know. One very practical, I find, for this verse where it says, you know, see others as supreme, see yourself as the lowest of all, and it's meaning everybody. Well, we can start with one person, and this is very practical. This is a practical approach, a practical example. There's always in our lives people we don't like. Maybe just people who annoy us, you know, that old auntie, that person at work. We've always got people like that. They're the ones we have aversion for. Well, a really powerful way to practice this one. Think of that person and think of one thing that they can do that's better than you at it. This is a very simple example. Maybe they've got cuter ears. Maybe their feet are nicer. Maybe they're more intelligent. Maybe they've got a prettier nose. I mean, I'm meaning something really as simple as that. Maybe they're better at something else. And you might hate all their other qualities, but think of one thing they can do better. That means they are higher. We don't like to think this way in the West. It sounds like judgment. It sounds scary. Because why we find it so scary is because we have so much low self-esteem. And low self-esteem is the flip side of pride. We're going to talk about the delusions in much more depth. This is very depressing. The reason we think we're creeps, the reason we have low self-esteem is because we have arrogance. This is hard to see. If we did not have arrogance, if we did not have pride, we would never have low self-esteem. We would never feel that way. It's very interesting to look into that, and we'll go into that in more depth. So because we have low self-esteem, because we have pride, we find all these kind of views very scary, heavy, judgmental, punishment. That's how we hear it. Buddha doesn't mean it like that. We hear it like that. We put all those projections onto it, you know. So we'll go into all that later. So we're going to have dinner. All of a sudden we're having dinner again. So think of our dinner. We haven't talked about emptiness yet, so we won't go there. But let's think of it again in terms, especially of kindness. Think of all the sentient beings. It's a really good way to think about dinner. Just think. You don't have to look holy when you think. Just think it. Think. It is the work of sentient beings. All those sentient beings have suffered and died for our food. People have cooked it, have grown it, have planted it, have served it, have cut it. This is true. Fact. All these sentient beings all working together. For them, for their work, I get my lunch. I get my dinner. That's pretty amazing. Yeah, we created the cause, but we do it with this attitude of kindness. We're going to eat it to be fat and healthy so we can repay their kindness. But the other, let's add the other one of offering it as well. Let's offer. That's where we create so much virtue as well. So let's just think of this delicious food. We imagine we bless it with the energy of all the holy beings, body, speech, and mind. Om Ahung, Om Ahung, just melting into it. And now we imagine all the gurus, all the Buddhas, all the bodhisattvas, and all the suffering sentient beings of all the realms of existence, pervading space. And then as Rinpoche says, in Tantra, the very meaning of the word to offer, chur in Tibetan, puja in Sanskrit, is to visualize the recipients experiencing the bliss of receiving it. We imagine that. So amazing. Lama Sange, Lama Chur, Dejen Lama Gerunte, Kungi Jepo Lama Te, Lama Namla Chirpa Bull. So what we've just done for like 1 minute is have a whole bunch of new thoughts that we've then plugged into this action called eating dinner, for which usually attachment is the main motivation. So before we've had the dinner, we've just put this amazing view of wanting to eat to be healthy to help others and of offering to all the trillions of beings in the universe, including the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the Gurus. So much virtuous karmic seeds planted in our mind just from those few thoughts. So those thoughts have become our motivation. So this has tempered our attachment and is making the action of eating a virtuous action. We understand that. We know how to transform our lives, you know. It's very easy. Just change your thoughts. So then we dedicate, again, just thinking, all these seeds we planted. Maybe nourish these with our effort from this second forward. So we do develop our marvelous potential, so we can be of benefit. So we can put our money where our mouth is, as we say in English. We can do what Harry did. Harry, that his action was the culmination of all his meditation. So, you know, may we become bodhisattvas. May we be able to have the courage to help others. Slowly, slowly. It's our potential. So how amazing. Jangchub, Semchok, Rinpoche, Ma ke panam ke guchi, ke panyampa, me pa yang, gong ne gondu pa wa shog. May we never develop, even for a moment, wrong views towards the deeds of our most precious gurus. With faith and respect gained from seeing their goodness, may their full inspiration flow into our hearts. Okay. Thank you, everyone.